In the following interview, we'll hear Kim Pape, the director of the Elizabeth Fry Societies. Kim Pape begins this interview by giving us some background of the closure of P4W, the prison for women, in Kingston, Ontario. And she continues by speaking on the building of new prisons for women across Canada and what they have evolved into despite recommendations of the Task Force on Federally Sentenced Women.
We're going to be talking to Kim Pape, who is the director of the Elizabeth Fry Society in Ottawa. Hello, Kim.
Hello.
I know that you've been working with Elizabeth Fry for about 10 years now.
Yeah, right? Almost 12. Okay. So yeah, and then with men and with kids before that.
So maybe you could talk us through or help us through the closure of P4W leading up to the building of the new prisons across Canada for women and what they've evolved to in spite of the recommendations of the task force.
Sure.
10 years ago.
Yeah, well, the Task Force on Federally Sentenced Women was, from our perspective, was a... It was a compromise position at best. You know, in corrections, people talk about it as the ultimate vision. It was the ideal notion of what would happen. When in fact, from our perspective, it was not, you know, as abolitionists, the last thing any of us intended to be doing was closing a prison to open up five new ones. Or in this case, we've opened up five new ones, plus there's now the Okemochee Healing Lodge. And for right now, there are still two segregated maximum security units in men's prisons. There were four up until just 2 months ago. So one of the things that we never intended was to see that kind of reality. The prison for women is closed now. It closed more than 6 years after the date it had been scheduled to close in 1994, but it closed in 2000, and it was replaced by a number of new prisons. However, everything that Madame Justice Arbour in 1995 and 1996 chronicled following the incidents at the prison for women in Kingston, when the human rights abuses, the charge abuses, the violation of the Corrections and Conditional Release Act happened, every one of those abuses has reoccurred in the new regional prisons. And I used to say, except the stripping of women by men, but I don't say that anymore, because even that's happened now. And so, for many women, it's hard to imagine how we've gone forward. For many women, they see it as a benefit to just be being closer to home. However, what that's also meant is having prisons in regions is that more women are being sentenced. So in just the time that I've been with E. Fry, we've seen a doubling of the number of women serving sentences of 2 years or more. Now, women are the fastest growing prison population worldwide anyway, and in Canada and here, that's linked to cuts to social programs, cuts to health care, particularly mental health services, psychiatric services, and it's linked to the growth in the Aboriginal population. It's linked to lots of other things, but the reality is that's the situation we're in, and increased sentencing is part of it, certainly in the prairies and the Atlantic region. So we've seen a massive problem in terms of, from our perspective, for some women being closer to home, being able to get out and be closer to family, make a link with their children and communities of origin. But for many women, it's been a real step away from what the vision of creating choices or the model of creating choices was, because many women have been kept in segregated maximum security units, first in the men's prisons, now in the women's. So that's what led us in on March 8th, 2001, International Women's Day. We picked that day purposefully to launch the human rights. We called it a complaint, but it was really what we asked for was a systemic review of what's happening to federally sentenced women in this country, with a view to a special report being issued and recommendations that would change fundamentally how women are treated in the country. So we've chronicled all the human rights abuses, the charter abuses, that sort of thing. We also sought and obtained some monies to be able to provide to other groups. So most importantly, from our perspective, was to women with the lived experience of imprisonment, women in prison right now, as well as women outside of prison. So groups like Strength and Sisterhood, Women for Justice, Joint Effort, a number of groups came together and did submissions around the human rights issues. Disabled Women's Network of Canada did, particularly around mental health issues and mental and cognitive disabilities. The Native Women's Association of Canada did submissions around the particular issues for Aboriginal women. NOIVM, National Organization of Immigrant and Visible Minority Women, have made submissions. The National Association of Women in the Law, Women's Legal Education and Action Fund. Oh, I mean, even some of the more, what would usually be thought of as more conservative women's groups, like Canadian Federation of University Women, National Council of Women of Canada made submissions, and Amnesty International also finally entered into the foray, which we'd been in trying to get Amnesty International to, since 1997 to start putting Canada on its agenda, particularly women's prisons, but, you know, also men's, what's happening in men's prisons. So they were part of it. All of those submissions are on our website. We're in the midst of doing an MP3 and CD. Every woman in prison will get a copy of the submissions. We'll get a copy of the CD with the oral submissions to the Human Rights Commission. And
what's the website?
The website is www.elizabethfry, that's just F-R-Y, .ca. And so all the human rights submissions are there, as well as some other position papers. And one of the things we're hoping is that by the end of the fall, we'll see recommendations coming from the Human Rights Commission in a couple of key areas. One is we've asked for external accountability, that corrections be held accountable by more than just the Office of the Correctional Investigator, who has no power to implement change, but perhaps something more like an Inspector General. I mean, we haven't named it that, but an external body that would also involve an external governance body that we've recommended be chaired by a group like CIS, or co-chaired by CIS CAFES, a series of, and that would include some of the key women's groups who have taken abolitionist positions and have also continued to work on a day-to-day basis or a regular basis with women inside to try and assist them in getting through the prison sentence and integrating into the community once they're out. So that's one recommendation. Another is for compensation for women who have been jailed, particularly Aboriginal women. We've got a really good piece that Patricia Montour has done for CAFES, but it focuses specifically on Aboriginal women and is also applicable to the women with disabilities, in our view, which is that there's a fiduciary duty, which is basically a duty of a direct responsibility. Usually fiduciary duty in law is used to talk about the relationship between a doctor and a patient, a teacher and a student, and that sort of thing. We're arguing that because of the nature of the Indian Act and Aboriginal peoples, particularly Aboriginal women, there's a direct relationship between the over-incarceration of women and a breach of the government's duty to take care of Aboriginal peoples because of the Indian Act. Similarly, because of the cuts, the 1996 elimination of the Canada Assistance Plan, the elimination of national standards for health care, social services, and the allowance of provinces to spend money in different ways and not allocate resources for those areas, the federal government has also breached its fiduciary duty to individuals with cognitive and mental disabilities. And so now we're arguing, you could argue that also for prisoners in general, but in particular those groups stand out as groups where the federal government, by not following through on a responsibility it has directly set up increasingly those discrete groups, but all people to be increasingly at risk of being criminalized. So compensation, we've also recommended that because access to justice issues are so huge in this country, have always been, or even more so now, with cuts to legal aid, with increased numbers of poor people not able to have any kind of defense before the courts, we're concerned that there also be a prison challenges fund, or for lack of a better term, which would be similar to what was set up for the court challenges fund, recognizing that when the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms came in, Section 15, which was the equality provisions that protected the equality of people based on sex, disability, race, I can't remember, I'm going to forget all the grounds, but sexual orientation, I mean the whole list, the recognition was that the people who fall into that group who would seek the protection would rarely have the resources to be able to take the government to court. So a special fund was set up, and so we're arguing similarly there should be a special fund set up for prisoners. And we're calling for a decarceration strategy to be implemented immediately for Aboriginal peoples and women with mental and cognitive disabilities. And if that alone happened, we would see probably emptying out of almost 90% of our women from the prison. Because right now, Aboriginal women are 27% of the jail population. Women with mental health issues depends on what they count, what corrections counts, what you know, how the women self-identify. But corrections themselves say there are very few women who don't have depression. Well, some would characterize that as a mental illness or mental health issue. Certainly, I don't know of anybody who goes into prison who doesn't get depressed, because, you know, how can you not? But certainly there are the women who are filling up our maximum security units are not women who are there because they're a risk to the public, are not there because they pose any great security breach or risk to the country, but they are there because of their institutional adjustment. And as you know, those three ways you can be classified as maximum security. And one is your risk to the public safety, your risk to escape, and your institutional adjustment. And not surprising, women who have significant mental health issues, disabilities, women with cognitive disabilities have a real tough time adjusting in the prison, as do many Aboriginal women who their mere ability to survive is predicated on them resisting authority, you know, whether it's in, you know, first starting at residential schools, child welfare, in general in school situations, the community. And that resistance to authority, of course, makes them difficult to manage in any institutional setting, particularly a prison. And that's the way that most of the women are classified as maximum security. We had a really good example after, I don't know if you recall, in 1997, after they started opening the segregated max units in the men's prisons. They planned, there was one opened in Saspen in Prince Albert in Saskatchewan, one opened in the Regional Psychiatric Centre in Saskatoon in Saskatchewan, one opened in Saint-Anne-de-Plaine in Quebec, one opened in Spring Hill in Nova Scotia. There was also one planned for KP, for Kingston Penitentiary. There were supposed to be 34 beds for women, and that was based on 17 for women with mental and cognitive disabilities, and 17 for what they called straight max, almost like a supermax. We went to court with the women. The women launched an action and we went as a separate party. And when it was clear that we were going to win the case, which would have meant, if we won the case, it would have meant a proclamation, a declaration that that kind of incarceration was illegal of women in segregated max units in men's prisons. So corrections abandoned it and said they changed their mind, they weren't going to do that with women in the Ontario region, left the women temporarily in Kingston, in prison for women. And then, though, when they closed prison for women, there were no women classified as maximum security in the Ontario region. So they went from supposedly needing 34 beds to having none. And then they had one or two over the next few years. And then as they started to, you know, I think, you know, my view is, as they started to realize they needed to justify why they were building this new max unit at Grand Valley in Kitchener, the Grand Valley Institution, they suddenly started classifying, in the space of 18 months, classified 11 women as maximum security. Now, it's still 11 versus 34, but the reality is what they showed us is that, in fact, their classification scheme is biased. It's biased against women. It's gender, race, class biased. It's certainly biased against sexual orientation, against disability, all, you know, all of the above. So there are some really good papers, too, that are being have challenged the classification scheme, and there's some of that in our human rights complaint. So one of the challenges we have ahead, in addition to the human rights piece, which we plan to take internationally next after the report comes out, is a challenge to actually get those max units in the women's prisons closed that have just been opened up.
The human rights complaint, or the systemic review that you guys were hoping for in launching, did that come out of the 1994 incidences at P4W?
Not exactly. What happened was, after Madame Justice Arbour did her report, where it was such a scathing indictment of what corrections was doing and had very many good recommendations. Of course, it's never everything we would hope to have, but it was certainly a far sight closer than anything we'd seen before or since. But what we noticed was in 2000, in fact, we started chronicling how much had actually been implemented of what she recommended, and realized that in that five, six, at that time it was just under four, it was 4.5 years, virtually nothing had been implemented that she'd recommended. There'd been, you know, a nominal recommendation, like she had recommended Deputy Commissioner for Women to govern women's corrections. Well, there is a Deputy Commissioner for Women, but it's a title, has no power, has no veto power, has no ability to influence what happens in the women's prisons, only has the ability to be at the Executive Committee table of Correctional Service of Canada and try to influence what's developed there. She has some staff But there was always a what they used to call a female offender unit. Then they called federally sentenced women. Now they call a women offender unit in National Headquarters, Correctional Service of Canada. So that's still there, and she's there entitled, but doesn't have all the requisite resources, the line authority, all of the sorts of things that she recommended. So we decided that for the fifth anniversary of Madame Justice Arbour's recommendations, which was 2001, that we would launch this review. We talked to the Canadian Human Rights Commission, and they indicated they were willing to do the review, and so they have agreed to do the review and issue a special report on the systemic discrimination experienced by women prisoners. But they also said that they didn't have very many resources, so we sought resources independent of the Human Rights Commission and did a parallel process. So the materials that you'll find on our website that we'll have the CDs soon of and the MP3s, those have all been done separately so that it can also be a standalone piece. And we are in some United Nations bodies that are NGOs that are working in this area have already asked for the material, and we will be sending it to United Nations as well, because of course it impacts on the UN minimum standard rules for prisoners, impacts on the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, impacts on the Convention Against Torture, the Human Rights Convention, you know, so a number of areas that it impacts.
So is that what you mean, that you're going internationally?
That's right. Yeah. And one of the issues when you go internationally is you have to show them that you've exhausted all internal remedies. We've gone to court against corrections, we've had the Arbour Commission, and we really saw the human rights piece as the very last. We didn't want to do a series of individual complaints, because, I mean, there are complaints that are still before the court. Gail Horry's human rights complaint is now 15, maybe even more, 14, 15, 16 years old, and still not resolved. So we know how long it grinds along to do that, and that's why we went for the systemic review. So it will not only exhaust all the remedies, if they come up with some great recommendations and if some changes happen as a result of it, that would be great. But even if they don't, the process will mean we'll be able to take it outside of Canada.
And you mentioned earlier that two maxis have been closed in the past 2 months. How did that happen?
Well, when the segregated max units in the men's prisons were opened in 1996 and 1997, the then commissioner and the deputy commissioner for women said that they were temporary arrangements, 18 to 24 months. Now you can do the math as well as I can. 1996, 18 to 24 months takes you significantly, you know, closer to 1996 than to where we are now. So they were always planned to be closed. They were always deemed to have been a temporary measure. And in fact, it's part of what has limited us being able to go to court, is because, you know, we know that corrections, you know, with limited resources that the women have or we have, corrections just says that, well, it's a temporary measure. It's not the plan. We're in the midst of building these max units. And it's why more of our energy now will go to fighting the max units in the women's prisons. I mean, it's not that we haven't fought the max units in the men's prisons, but it was a difficult one. And partly because some of the women had been held in remand centers in the prairies, for instance, after the women were moved from Edmonton Institution before they were moved to Saspen, many of them were kept in remand centers. So for them, there was not an interest in challenging, mainly because they didn't know, and nor could we assure them of where they would go if, in fact, those units were closed. We couldn't assure them they would go to the Edmonton Women's Prison, and we couldn't either confirm that they wouldn't go to the remand centers again. So the women there didn't want to risk it. As well, many of them were from Saskatchewan. They actually saw their families more, paradoxically, when they were in Saspen than they do in Edmonton Institution. So yeah, and the other two are due to close. Right now, it's been political, really. I mean, the Spring Hill Institution and the Saskatchewan Penitentiary have had the most media attention, mainstream media attention, and negative media attention for violating women's rights. There was a suicide in Saspen. There have been many hunger strikes and hostage takings. And for women to be involved in hostage takings, you know the conditions have to be abysmal. I mean, for men to be involved in hostage takings, you know it's a sign of the conditions are deteriorating significantly, because that doesn't happen unless there's a significant problem in the institution. But it's even more so in my experience from working with men and women. I mean, women will start slashing, which they did. They'll start stringing up and trying to kill themselves. They'll do all kinds of other things first. They may start fighting amongst themselves, but when they actually start attacking the staff, I've never seen a riot, despite what, in a women's prison. But the hostage takings was the most serious we'd ever seen, and that was a clear indication that in the suicides that the women were, you know, the desperation was incredibly high. And so our view is that's the only reason those two were closed first, was just to get some media attention away from the Correctional Service of Canada, because media hardly ever goes to Saint-Anne-de-Plaine. And the Regional Psychiatric Center in Saskatoon, the women often, you know, just the fact that they are women with mental and cognitive disabilities means that they're discredited. They may say, you know, tell someone to fuck off when they come in to do an interview, and it's immediately discredited, or they may, you know, flip out on them in some other way, not illegitimately, but they'll be treated as though, in, you know, in our view, often in a fairly dismissive way by the media and by others who see them, particularly if they don't understand the context of their situation.